following is a previously broadcast program.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
When you look at the video, it harkens back to yesteryears, things we thought we had overcome in America. I mean, it looks like it's a lynch mob chasing a young black man, and when they kill him, there is no accountability. They go home and sleep in their beds at night.
Jury selection is continuing in Georgia in the trial of three white men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed 25-year-old black man who was chased down and shot to death while out for a Sunday jog. We'll speak to Arbery's aunt and one of the family's lawyers. Then, as President Biden campaigns for his Build Back Better agenda, we'll take a close look at how Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona are fighting Biden on everything from taxing the rich to expanding dental care.
But here's the thing. Mr. Manchin is opposed to that, as is, I think, Senator Sinema.
Then to Pfizer's power. Public Citizens revealed how Pfizer's bullying governments in COVID-19 vaccine negotiations as part of a push to increase their profits during the pandemic.
Pfizer has used its monopoly on a life-saving vaccine to extract concessions from desperate governments. The contracts consistently place Pfizer's interests before public health imperatives.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our audience. Our top story contains graphic descriptions of violence and sexual abuse. A damning new report reveals the scope of the humanitarian crisis unfolding at the U.S.-Mexico border. Human Rights Watch uncovered over 160 harrowing reports of abuse faced by asylum seekers at the hands of U.S. immigration officials over the past 5 years. The internal reports obtained through a public records request were made by asylum officers within U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services using testimonies that detail the brutal conduct of Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. This is part of a video accompanying the report published by Human Rights Watch.
He put a gun to my head and he said, "Shut up or I'll shoot you."
The officer said if I gave him sex, I would be set free.
He told me, "I enjoy when I capture people like you," and then kicked me.
They call us son of bitches, dogs, parasites, trash.
They say that because my child was a U.S. citizen, they will take him from me.
In one account, a man from Honduras said a Border Patrol agent told him he would be denied asylum in the U.S., and when the man refused to sign paperwork, the agent said he would be sent to jail where he would be raped. Another incident involves an officer who forced a migrant girl to undress and inappropriately touched her. In a statement, Human Rights Watch warned that assault, sexual abuse, and discriminatory treatment by U.S. agents are an open secret within the Department of Homeland Security. In more immigration news, a spokesperson for Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott says National Guard troops deployed to the southern border have helped Texas law enforcement officers detain over 7,700 migrants. They're among more than 70,000 asylum seekers who've been arrested by Texas law enforcement since Abbott launched the anti-immigrant program Operation Lone Star back in March. In related news, the attorneys general of Texas and Missouri have sued the Biden administration in a bid to force the U.S. to resume border wall construction along the U.S.-Mexico border. Meanwhile, the group Human Rights First has tracked over 7,600 reports of kidnappings and other brutal attacks against asylum seekers who are blocked from applying for refuge in the U.S. or expelled under Title 42 since President Biden took office. Many of those barred under the Trump-era policy were Haitian asylum seekers. In Haiti, the leader of a gang suspected of kidnapping 16 American and one Canadian missionary members is threatening to kill the hostages if the $17 million ransom is not paid, $1 million for each person. Haiti's National Police Chief Leon Charles resigned Thursday after the video featuring the threat surfaced. This comes amidst a worsening economic and security situation in Haiti. On Monday, workers went on a general strike to protest gang violence and insecurity following the kidnapping. Meanwhile, demonstrators blocked the streets of Port-au-Prince Thursday to protest widespread fuel shortages.
We are protesting because we want authorities to listen to our demands. If we cannot work, we cannot fulfill our responsibilities. We are citizens who are working for the community. There's no gasoline and our children are hungry.
A new report by the People's Vaccine Alliance found only about 260 million of the 1.8 billion COVID-19 vaccine donations promised to poorer nations by drug companies in wealthier countries have been delivered to date. That's just 14% of what was pledged. Gordon Brown, the World Health Organization's ambassador for global health financing, said rich countries are on pace to have almost a billion spare vaccines stockpiled by February.
To have the vaccines available in one half of the world and yet to deny them to the other half of the world is one of the greatest international public policy failures imaginable. And it's a moral catastrophe of historic proportions that will shock future generations.
The WHO estimates between 80,000 and 180,000 healthcare workers have died of COVID-19 from the start of the pandemic through May of this year. Just 2 out of 5 healthcare workers worldwide are fully vaccinated. We'll have more on vaccine inequity and profit over people later in the broadcast. The British medical journal The Lancet warns in a new report that without dramatic action to curb greenhouse gas emissions, the climate crisis is on track to become the defining narrative of human health in the 21st century. The Lancet warns of the spread of mosquito-borne diseases and growing mass migration due to flooding, drought, intense storms, wildfires, and soil and water salinification. On Thursday, the Biden administration warned climate catastrophe poses a widening threat to national security with the mass displacement of whole populations and increased competition over dwindling resources driving political instability around the globe. Meanwhile, a major leak of documents published by Greenpeace reveals how Brazil, Argentina, Australia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and OPEC tried to water down a key United Nations scientific report ahead of the COP26 climate talks in Glasgow. In one comment, a senior Australian government official rejected the conclusion that coal-fired power plants should be phased out to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is John Sovin, executive director of Greenpeace UK.
They asked to be deleted the fact that they're a major coal producer. Now, this is particularly bizarre because I think Australia is about the fifth largest coal producer in the world. It's also first or second with Indonesia, the largest coal exporter in the world. And obviously, it also has a big, you know, coal industry in terms of power from coal inside Australia itself. And no plans actually to phase out coal during the course of the next 3 decades. So I think it's quite extraordinary that Australia should say, please delete this.
Back in the United States, the House of Representatives voted Thursday to declare former Trump aide Stephen Bannon in contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena from the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack. The vote was 229 to 202. 9 Republicans joined Democrats in support of the resolution to recommend the Justice Department open a criminal prosecution of Bannon. This is House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer.
Steve Bannon's refusal to appear, even when subpoenaed, is a demonstration of his contempt not only for Congress, but his contempt of the Constitution and his contempt for the law. It is unacceptable and obstructive to this process of uncovering the full story of that day's attack on the Capitol.
On January 5th, one day before the violent insurrection, Steve Bannon predicted January 6th would be a game changer in U.S. politics, telling his radio audience all hell is going to break loose. If convicted, Bannon faces up to 1 year in prison and a fine of up to $100,000. Johnson & Johnson is under fire for using a legal trick to avoid liability over its asbestos-laced talcum powder, which has been linked to cancer. Thanks to a Texas loophole, J&J spun off a separate company to absorb nearly 40,000 lawsuits, then filed that entity for bankruptcy, putting all those cases on pause pending a bankruptcy settlement. J&J heavily marketed its baby powder to African-American women for years with the knowledge its product contained asbestos. In New Mexico, actor Alec Baldwin was questioned by police after he discharged a prop firearm on a movie set, killing the director of photography, Helena Hutchins, and injuring director Joel Souza. The cast and crew were filming a Western called Rust. The news was met with shock in Hollywood and an outpouring of tributes for 42-year-old Helena Hutchins, a rising star in an industry where women cinematographers are still vastly underrepresented. Helena Hutchins was from Ukraine. She grew up on a Soviet military base in the Arctic Circle. Earlier this week, Hutchins reposted a photo on Instagram of the Rust crew on set with a message of solidarity with the IATSE union struggle. And Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has endorsed India Walton in the race to become the next mayor of Buffalo, New York, calling her an inspiring community leader. Walton, who identifies as a socialist, stunned the Democratic establishment in June by beating four-term incumbent mayor Byron Brown in the Democratic primary. Despite this, Brown is now waging a write-in campaign in the November 2nd general election, and other prominent New York Democrats like Governor Kathy Hochul and Congressmember Brian Higgins, who represents Buffalo, have refused to back Walton, as has the New York Democratic Party. India Walton appeared on Democracy Now! Earlier this week.
Buffalo is 65% Democrats. So anyone who's going to run a successful campaign for mayor here pretty much has to be a Democrat. But the values of our current administration have not displayed the values that I believe Democrats hold, which is putting people and workers and families first.
You can see the rest of our interview with India Walton at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Georgia, jury selection began this week in the trial of three white men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery, the unarmed 25-year-old black man who was chased down and shot to death while out for a jog last year in the suburbs of Brunswick, Georgia. Many have compared his death to a modern-day lynching. A warning to our viewers and listeners. This segment contains graphic descriptions of violence. On February 23, 2020, Gregory McMichael and his son Travis McMichael saw Arbery jogging, grabbed guns, and pursued him in a pickup truck. Their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit in his own truck, recording the video on a cell phone. The McMichaels claim they were attempting a citizen's arrest of Ahmaud Arbery. Travis McMichael fired two shots, killing Ahmaud. The elder McMichael was a former Glynn County police officer and investigator for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit prosecutor Jackie Johnson. She was recently indicted for directing police not to arrest Travis McMichael and then steering the case to a sympathetic prosecutor. It was a third prosecutor who ultimately filed the murder charges in the case after the video evidence became public, sparking widespread outcry. We're joined now by two guests. Lee Merritt is a civil rights attorney representing the family of Ahmaud Arbery. And Thea Brooks is the aunt of Ahmaud Arbery. She's been leading rallies outside the Glynn County Courthouse in Georgia since Monday. I want to thank you so much, Thea Brooks, for being with us. Our deep condolences on the death of your nephew. I know he lived with you at the end of his life, and you've been monitoring closely what's happening this week in the courtroom. Can you talk about the kind of community support people have come from all over the country to Brunswick to see what's happening in the courtroom?
Well, first, let me clear up. He never lived with me. I heard you say that he lived with me, but he never lived with me, so I'm not sure where that came from.
Sorry.
But the support that has come to Brunswick has been amazing. People have rallied from all over the world to come and support and help be the eyes and ears, to help focus on what's going on at hand, and to help support us and push us through to get justice for Ahmaud.
So I was wondering if you can talk about that level of support and what it means. I was just reading a story about how the judge was responding to the defense attorneys demanding that all the signs be taken down outside. The judge noting the courthouse grounds are a public space. He suggested the objecting defense attorneys draft a legal motion, quote, walking me through the First Amendment rights you seek to infringe upon and how you intend to do this, he said. Can you tell us about the scene outside and the signs people are carrying, the T-shirts people are wearing, and why this, you feel, has captured the attention of so many?
Well, the signs outside the courthouse are just merely what they are. There's signs that say justice for Ahmaud. There's signs that say find these men who killed Ahmaud guilty. And there's support signs. You see this so many other places. You saw it in Minneapolis. You saw it when Philando Castile was killed. You've seen it so many places. So I'm not understanding what the issue is here in Brunswick, Georgia. But I do understand that we face a lot of injustices here. And this is just another part of the injustices that we face. The signs are support. I don't see what the issue is. And these people came from Washington, Pennsylvania, Virginia, all over the world just to be here as support. So, you know, when they file these type of motions, it just makes me, you know, question our judicial system and the things that we're still facing today.
Can you tell us about Ahmaud? Tell us who he was. Describe this young man who was cut down in the prime of his life.
Ahmaud and I spent a lot of time together in his younger years, his infant toddler years. As he got older, his mom, she moved to another part of Brunswick, and we kind of lost connection. A couple of months before Ahmaud was killed, we spent a lot of time together out at his house. His mom was working out in Texas, and so we never missed a beat. If I ran into him on his jog, if I saw him out at Blue Beacon where he was working, he was still a bright young man. He had a beautiful smile. He was amazing. He always offered. He was a giver. He would see me and say, can I buy you lunch? Or, you know, do you have money? If not, I can give. And I would always tell him, you know, you keep your money and I'll buy lunch. But he was just such an amazing young man. He was bright. He had a bright future. He had a dream. He loved to rap. He loved to spend time with his cousins who were like his brothers. He loved his brother and sister. But most of all, he loved his mom. His mom was everything to him. She was a jewel in his eyesight. And he was just an amazing young man. And that was something that they took away from us. You know, you don't find many times where you can say that the younger people now that are coming up are just these remarkable people. And no matter what they do in their past, they still are great people. And Ahmaud was love. And that's all I can really say about him. He was love. He was that child that everybody would want.
We also have Lee Merritt with us, attorney for the family of Ahmaud Arbery. Lee, this This story is not often talked about as a story about law enforcement. They talk about three white men, right? The McMichaels father and son team and Roddy Bryant. But in fact, Gregory McMichael and his son Travis, who got in that pickup truck and hunted down Ahmaud and ultimately killed him. The elder McMichael was a former Glynn County police officer and investigator for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit prosecutor, Jackie Johnson. And she was recently indicted for directing police not to arrest the son and then steering the case to a sympathetic prosecutor. Can you take us through this prosecution, Lee Merritt?
Yes. When you say take you through the prosecution, you
want to— talk about the connection to law enforcement and how long this took, actually, to bring charges and the final release of that video, amazingly, by the third man who's been arrested here.
Sure. So in February of 2020, this all happened. It took 74 days before anyone was arrested, and that was only after— one of the defendants decided that this video would help clear up some of the rumors that were going on about how Ahmaud was murdered. And so he released it under the direction of his attorney. He released it to a local radio station. By then, Wanda had been contacting the then appointed prosecutor in the case, which by the time that happened, we were on our third prosecutor to get the case before a grand jury. To arrest these men. And when the video was released, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation got involved because of the national outcry. It went almost immediately viral. And then the dominoes began to fall.
And the fact that Gregory McMichael was in law enforcement, was a police officer, was an investigator.
Yeah.
And then that connection to Jackie Johnson, who herself, this Brunswick Judicial Circuit prosecutor, has just been charged.
So Greg McMichael worked in law enforcement in Glynn County for decades. His most recent job that he had just retired from the year previously was an investigator for Jackie Johnson, the then Glynn County prosecutor, right after Ahmaud was murdered. Before he actually received medical care, Gregory McMichael was on the phone with his old boss saying that he needed help. Now, it was Jackie Johnson's responsibility at that point to conflict out of the case. To let the attorney general of the state know that, you know, there was a murder that took place in her region. She didn't have the jurisdiction because of her conflict to deal with it. Instead, she moved the prosecution, as you mentioned, to a sympathetic prosecutor, George Barnhill, and she continued to sort of put her thumbs on the scale of justice. She let law enforcement know these men should not be arrested. She instructed them not to arrest the McMichaels. And ever since then, you know, that community is so small. We're learning how small it is from the jury selection process. But that community, George Barnhill's, for example, his son also worked for Jackie Johnson. And there was a lot of inappropriate relationships that were allowed to continue despite the obvious conflicts. Mm.
And can you talk about the citizen arrest law that the McMichaels used as an excuse to stop Ahmaud, which has been repealed by Georgia state lawmakers? How does that change the defense?
Yeah, so the citizen's arrest law, which is an old civil rights era law on the books that ultimately was designed to keep Black people out of traditionally white neighborhoods, and that's how it had been used. In order to successfully avail themselves of even that law, they would have to first prove that they witnessed Ahmaud during the course of a crime, a felony, or that he committed a crime or a felony within their immediate knowledge. Here, they said that they saw Ahmaud running and had a gut instinct that he may have been involved in some other car taking items out of the car. I'm not sure the exact criminal statute for that, but taking items out of the car, that would not suffice under the law. It is the defense that they're still fighting for. And of note, the people of Georgia elected to remove that defense from the books. It is still available for the McMichaels and Mr. Bryan for his defense, but ultimately that law is no longer available.
Thea Brooks, can you talk about how often Ahmaud was in that neighborhood of Brunswick? And can you talk about the description of the community and the division between white and black, kind of informal segregation?
Well, Ahmaud not only jogged in that community, Ahmaud jogged all over Glenn County. That was his thing. He spent a lot of time, he jogged a lot out that way because that's where he lived. He ultimately was like, literally, if he would have been able to get out of the neighborhood on the road that he was jogging on to escape those gentlemen, all he had to do was literally jog across the highway and he would have been in his neighborhood. So I found it at one point, I thought it would be safer when he was jogging out there through the neighborhoods, because the main highway that leads to his route is a very busy highway. It's considered Highway 17, which we call 82 here. There are a lot of tractor trailers that drive out there. There is actually a truck stop out there. So it's a very busy highway that leads to Interstate 95. So you would think that jogging in neighborhoods would be a safer place to jog because of the traffic and how heavy the traffic is out there. So Ahmaud's jog was a daily jog unless it was pouring down rain and he just couldn't get out. But he ran every day. And so ultimately, you're talking about what we experience here. There's a lot of injustice that happens here in Glenn County. We've seen it in many other cases, not just Ahmaud's case. This community is somewhat in some ways. There are areas still that, just like Ahmaud's situation, that we go and we get questioned for being in the neighborhoods because it's predominantly a white neighborhood or it's an all-white neighborhood. And so when we go into these neighborhoods, they do question it. I find myself sometimes running into it, even on my job, because I'm the only person of color at my job. So there are days where it's questioned, you know, about me even being here. So we deal with it on a regular basis. It's nothing that just started, but it's something now that people are paying attention to.
And the running community, Thea, has come out in support of Ahmaud. Tons of Run for Ahmaud T-shirts and signs.
Yes, that's actually happening all over the world. When Ahmaud was killed, once the video dropped, you saw signs, you saw T-shirts. There are signs in yards. People wear shirts every day. They've even this week, a lot of people have turned their photos on their Facebook, their profile photos to pictures of Ahmaud in support of the I Run With Ahmaud. So there is no longer a campaign called I Run With Ahmaud. That has been, it's gone to 223 Foundation. So people now are just predominantly individually continuing to run for Ahmaud on their own.
So, Lee Merritt, can you talk about how jury selection is going, what you see here? And you've got the new hate crime laws that have been passed by the new Georgia State Legislature. What role will this play in the trial?
The jury selection process in Glenn County is going to be difficult. It's always a challenge to find neutral jurors. But in a place like Glenn County, for one of the most high-profile cases in the history of Georgia, if not of the country, it's impossible to find anyone in that small community who has not heard about what happened to Ahmaud. The prosecutors and the defense, the judge as well, they kind of accepted this as a reality, that they're going to be dealing with jurors who are not blank slates like we prefer. The jurors that have come in, however, many of them went to school with the accused. At least one of the jurors who, to my surprise, was actually qualified to sit on the jury, works in the office of Jackie Johnson, works in the Glenn County Prosecutor Office, was hired by Jackie Johnson campaigned for Jackie Johnson after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and knows Greg McMichael personally. In court, she referred to him sort of casually as Greg. And the court said that somebody with that many connections, whose job it was, she was basically the custodian of the records, which means a lot of the evidence that we were viewing in court was signed by her. And the court said, despite the fact that she could be called as a witness, that she was qualified to sit on the jury. I'm sure the prosecution will use a preemptory strike later on down the line to remove her from the jury. But the fact that she wasn't disqualified for what is called cause is beyond me. So far, they've been able to get together 23 qualified jurors of over 600 subpoenas that were sent out or jury summons that were sent out. Of those 23, the magic number they're trying to get to is 64. And then the jury selection process actually begins, where the prosecution and defense can begin selecting and striking jurors.
So with the video documenting that the McMichaels used the N-word after killing Ahmaud, how do you see race playing in this?
Well, the video does not document that the McMichaels used the N-word. The documentarian, one of the defendants, William Roddy Bryan, in his attempt to disassociate with the McMichaels, he offered into evidence during the preliminary trials that the McMichaels used the N-word. Race is going to be a central theme in this case because the prosecution, and I believe rightfully so, has acknowledged that race is at the center of these men's actions. They're going to claim, of course, that they targeted Ma because they suspected him of crime, specifically of going into that open dwelling. What you also hear from them, and what we've seen already, is that many, many people are seen on camera going into that open dwelling.
You mean a house that was not being built?
That's correct. The house that was still under construction. Many people were seen on camera going into that dwelling. Ahmaud had been there more than once. He had never committed any crimes there. He was the only person criminalized for his place, for just being on the premises. And we believe, and the evidence we believe will show, that he was targeted because of his race, and that these men were deeply racist. And there are social media posts and text messages that center around the issue of race. And even after Ahmaud was killed, some of the banter that we see on social media between the McMichaels and the community was celebratory concerning the fact that they had killed a black man in that community.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Lee Merritt, attorney for the family of Ahmaud Arbery. And thank you so much to Thea Brooks, aunt of Ahmaud Arbery. And again, our deepest condolences. Coming up, as President Biden campaigns for his Build Back Better agenda, we'll look at the records of Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona fighting Biden at every turn. Stay with us.
Bye.
go by Saul. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. During a CNN town hall Thursday night, President Biden defended his domestic agenda, but acknowledged key aspects of his Build Back Better plan are in jeopardy due to two Senate Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. With the Senate evenly split, Biden needs support from both of them to pass the plan through the reconciliation process. Biden's initial proposal called for $3.5 trillion over 10 years to vastly expand the social safety net and combat the climate crisis. But after facing opposition from Manchin and Sinema, Biden has reportedly lowered the top-line price tag on the package to $1.75 trillion, half the original bill. Manchin, who has millions of dollars in the coal industry in West Virginia, has also demanded Democrats strip out funding for the Clean Electricity Performance Program, a critical climate initiative to replace coal and gas-fired power plants with renewable energy sources. On Thursday, CNN's Anderson Cooper questioned Biden about health care provisions in the bill.
One of the other things that Democrats are looking to do is to expand Medicare to include dental, vision, and hearing as well. Given all the negotiations that are going on, will all three of those still be covered?
That's a reach. And the reason why it's a reach, it's not this, I think it's a good idea. And it's not that costly in relative terms, especially if we allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices. But here's the thing. Mr. Manchin is opposed to that, as is, I think, Senator Sinema is as
opposed
well.
To all of them?
Opposed to all three, mm-hmm. because they don't want, he says, he doesn't want to further burden Medicare.
Biden also talked more about Senator Sinema's opposition to his domestic agenda.
She's smart as the devil, number one. Number two, she's very supportive of the environmental agenda in my legislation. Very supportive. She's supportive of almost all the things I mentioned relating to everything from family care to all those issues. Where she's not supportive is she says she will not raise a single penny in taxes on the corporate side and or on wealthy people, period.
In fact, five advisors to Senator Sinema quit yesterday, saying she is putting the profits of her donors over the service to the people. Biden also made news when he appeared to support overhauling the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation. He was questioned by Anderson Cooper.
When it comes to voting rights, just so I'm clear, though, you would entertain the notion of doing away with the filibuster on that one issue? Is that correct?
And maybe more.
And maybe other issues.
Both Senators Manchin and Sinema have opposed reforming the filibuster. We turn now to look more closely at the two conservative Democrats fighting Biden. Joining us from West Virginia, Stephen Smith, co-chair of the West Virginia Can't Wait. He ran for governor of West Virginia in 2020, placing second in the Democratic primary. And joining us from Chicago is Branko Marcetic, staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. In March, he wrote an in-depth profile of Senator Kyrsten Sinema for Jacobin, headlined, How Kyrsten Sinema Went From Lefty Activist to Proud Neoliberal Democrat. He's also author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Well, you certainly cover a lot there, Branko. Let's start with Kyrsten Sinema. Most people may not know she was the campaign manager for Ralph Nader in Arizona. But talk about what's happening now. I mean, you've got all the advisors quitting yesterday, saying she's putting the profits of her donors over the people. Talk about what she stands for.
I mean, Sinema, I think, has really shown to stand mostly for the interests of the corporate sector, of the wealthy. And this isn't a new development. When she was in the House, she also she was one of the lawmakers who tried to and did repeal parts of Dodd-Frank financial reform law. She went after Obamacare, for instance, trying to repeal taxes on medical technology makers. She tried to get rid of the individual mandate and various other deregulatory actions. And it's all because, you know, she is trying to, I think, appeal to these interests because they fund her campaign. And she's been very lavishly rewarded. You know, she's one of the few Democrats who gets the Chamber of Commerce endorsement. She won the a Chamber of Commerce award, the Spirit of Enterprise award, 7 years in a row, because she got over 70% score from the Chamber of Commerce for her legislative work. So, I think this is what we're seeing right now is cinema is really listening to her constituents, and her constituents are not the people that voted her in. At least, you know, that's not what she considers as her most important constituency. She considers that to be the corporate sector, and she's, you know, most responsive to them. And I think what we're maybe seeing with some of these advisors quitting is that the kind of tack she's taking is now starting to see a real backlash that's been building for a while, but now is kind of reaching a boiling point that may actually end up haunting her long term.
And that famous image of her in the well of the Senate voting against raising the minimum wage. You know, John McCain famously gave a thumbs down in the well of the Senate. She did, too. Explain that moment.
Well, Sinema's clearly
trying to— He was doing it to save Obamacare. Herself.
Yeah, that's a very key thing to remember. She's trying to, I think, fashion herself as this kind of renegade or maverick in the style of John McCain. I mean, the reason that John McCain was considered a maverick was because he was seen, and I think this was overstated, but nonetheless, he was seen as a more sensible Republican, who, you know, for instance, would not elect to throw millions of people off healthcare, or a Republican who was very much in favor of reining in campaign donations and other things that are traditionally more associated with the Democrats. So, you know, McCain was someone who rightly or wrongly had this image of defying his party to do things that were, you know, very much in the interests of most working people. Sinema, on the other hand, is very much doing the opposite. She's being a maverick by fighting for corporate interests. So it's a completely topsy-turvy kind of version of what McCain was doing. It only harkens back to his career in a very superficial way, in the sense of spurning your party in a very visible and high profile way. But ultimately, you know, it's a very performative thing from Sinema that she's doing.
And can you talk more about the start of her career? I mean, now you have her going from her donor fundraisers to the White House to negotiate with Biden. But she began by attacking wealth inequality many years ago.
Yeah, she was a socialist, is what she called herself, at a time when it was very, very unfashionable to be a socialist. And, you know, unfortunately, I think for me, Sinema really reads as kind of a cautionary tale of what happens when political ambition becomes the be-all and end-all. You know, I don't think, at least so far, no one's found any glaring conflict of interest that she has. She's not particularly wealthy. She's not enriching herself. Aside from, you know, just getting her Senate salary, and she's not, you know, there's no other kind of element of corruption going on here. It seems to me from looking at her career that this has really just been a matter of her moving rightward and rightward every step of the way, little by little, until she's gone to this point, you know, where I think at first she was doing this as a matter of performance, as a matter of presentation. And I think at this point that performance has become the real thing. You know, you start out pretending to be one thing because you think it's going to appeal to a certain constituency. And before you know it, after, you know, 10, 15 years, that really becomes the thing that you are.
So specifically, in terms of a relationship with big money corporate Wall Street donors, last week Politico and the Daily Poster reported Sinema raised over $1.1 million between July and September, with 90% of the campaign donations coming from outside Arizona. At least $100,000 of those contributions came from people or entities linked to the drug or financial services industries. Top donors included pharma giant Gilead, CEO Daniel Day, who gave $5,000 this past quarter. Another $2,900 came from Eli Lilly, CEO David Ricks. The executive chair of Merck's board, Kenneth Frazier, gave $2,900, as did the chair and CEO of Bristol-Myers, Branko.
I mean, you know, there you have it. It's a very banal and depressing point, but it is true that money almost always wins out in Washington. And, you know, part of this might also be the problem of the fact that Biden split these two bills in part and also really slowed down the momentum of his presidency by trying to get this bipartisan buy-in. That I think was largely pointless. And that's allowed, you know, whereas the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups favor that much smaller bipartisan infrastructure bill, they're opposed to this $3.5 trillion one, largely because of the tax increases. Perhaps having them together would have neutralized some of that opposition. I don't know. But I think it's you know, because of the fact that they're split, because there's just months has gone by with just nothing happening. It's allowed people like Sinema to become a little more brave in their opposition. And at the same time, it's allowed lobbyists and political donors to, you know, come in here and wedge themselves in and sort of pry these two particularly, you know, vulnerable Democratic Santas apart from the rest of the caucus. So it's an unfortunate situation all around.
So speaking about this issue of the personal profit of these senators, I want to turn to Stephen Smith with West Virginia Can't Wait. A lot is made of, well, it's an ideological difference that Senator Manchin has with people like Senator Sanders, you know, calling Senator Sanders' dream of an entitlement society and saying he's opposed to that. But as we started this conversation yesterday on Democracy Now!, he is making millions of dollars personally over opposing, for example, stripping out renewable energy. He started these coal companies in the 1980s in West Virginia. His son is now taken over, and he's got the money in a blind trust, Manchin himself. His brother's deeply involved as well. Talk about Senator Manchin's interests and who exactly he's representing in West Virginia.
Thanks for this question. Yeah, it's a secret that the rest of the country is finally catching on to that we've known in West Virginia for decades, which is that Senator Manchin and the rest of our congressional delegation has never represented the people of our state. And that's what we're up against. You don't win higher office in West Virginia because you're a servant of the people. You win because your daddy was a politician or because you're rich. And you look at his donors, you look at his personal wealth off of this. You know, his top donors are the investment firms and corporate lawyers. And there aren't a lot of investment bankers or corporate lawyers in my neighborhood or most neighborhoods here in West Virginia. But Manchin, Capito, the rest of our delegation here in West Virginia, they are symptoms of a deeper disease, one that dates back to the founding of West Virginia, where our state has always been owned and operated by large out-of-state institutions, corporations, interests, and that's who our politicians are beholden to. And to defeat that, we need our own machine, a machine that replaces greed and corruption with generosity and accountability and the sort of neighbor-to-neighbor spirit that defines the way we experience West Virginia.
What doesn't the country know about Joe Manchin that you know in West Virginia?
I think it's important to see things from the point of view of folks on the ground here, that national media gets caught up in the person of Joe Manchin and the psychologizing and the sport of politics. On the ground right now in West Virginia is pain and death everywhere you look. In my hometown, we are home to the nation's most concerning HIV outbreak. And in response to that, Democratic and Republican politicians came together to criminalize harm reduction, criminalize the people who were fighting against that. We see historic rates of overdose deaths, one every 2 days in my hometown. We're losing our neighbors. Now, in response to that pain and death, most of us here, we look at that and we try to do everything we can to fight back, right? That's what West Virginia Can't Wait does. It's what neighbors do. It's what good neighbors do. What Senator Manchin does, what Senator Capito do when they see this pain and death is they think, how do I profit off of it? And that is fundamentally what's going on here. Politics in West Virginia has never been left versus right, red team versus blue team. It's the people who are suffering and dying and surviving versus the people who are trying to profit off of that pain.
I remember when Senator Manchin's daughter, who is head of the company that makes EpiPen, they increased the cost of EpiPen massively in one fell swoop, what so many people need in this country.
Yeah, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And that's why we have to be really smart about how we respond. Right. That the only way, and history tells us this, not just about Manchin, but again, the last century and a half of West Virginia history, the only way to persuade an establishment politician is to work like hell to replace them. The only time in Manchin's career where he's even moved a little bit are moments when his political life was threatened. And that threat has to be fearless. It has to be permanent. It has to be homegrown. And that's what we're building. West Virginia can't wait. We've got 110 pro-labor, no corporate cash, working class candidates we've trained up and down the ballot. We have 18 elected officials in office right now, and we provide them with policy support and legal support, mental health services, personal security if they need it as they face attacks from white supremacists. We have citizen journalists that we're sponsoring so that we've got some media that is accountable to the people. We're organizing slates all across West Virginia of candidates and issues where we're building local platforms, not just by going door to door, but also meeting with people who don't have a door to go home to and sending surveys into local jails and prisons. That we need a government that is accountable to the people and led by the people who have been excluded. And that only happens conversation by conversation, town by town, county by county.
Yesterday, I joked, you know, who is the president here? Is it President Joe Biden or is it President Joe Manchin? But President Biden last night in the town hall said, given that he has to get all 50 senators, every senator is, in a sense, president. And I wanted to go back to Branko for the last question, and that is, where are the other progressive senators on all of this speaking out?
Well, I mean, you saw with Sanders, he's kind of been taking the fight directly to Manchin. He wrote this op-ed in West Virginia, not quite attacking Manchin directly, but you know, it was clear what he meant. And I think that really the Democratic caucus has to be a lot more aggressive. I mean, right now, we have seen in the past that when it comes to getting progressives on board with certain legislation, the Democratic leadership has been very open to you know, turning on the screws and pressuring them to support it. And so it would be good to have a little more pressure put on Manchin from the rest of the Democrats. You know, I mean, unfortunately, the other factor here is that there aren't that many progressives in the Senate, at least. You know, it's a very lonely place to be a progressive. So that's the other half of this equation. I mean, you know, Chuck Schumer has really moved to the left, and you've got a few other people. But at the same time, it's very much the same people there who, you know, were in power years earlier when politics was very different and who, you know, are still very much stuck in that older playbook.
I dare say you could say that Schumer has very much moved because of the threat of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, perhaps challenging him in the next election for Senate. But we're going to have to leave it there for now. Branko Marcetic of Jacobin, we'll link to your piece, How Kyrsten Sinema Went from Lefty Activist to Proud Neoliberal Democrat, and Stephen Smith, co-chair of the West Virginia Can't Wait. Coming up, Pfizer's power. Stay with us.
I had tender feelings that you made hard. But it's your heart, not mine, that's scarred. So when I go home, I'll be happy to go. You're just somebody that I used to know. You don't need my help anymore. It's all now to you, there ain't no before. Now that you're big enough to run your own show, you're just somebody that I used to know. I watched you deal in a dying day,
Somebody I Used to Know by Elliot Smith. This is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how one of the leading COVID-19 vaccine makers appears to have restricted access to those very vaccines. The People's Vaccine Alliance says just 14% of the 1.8 billion doses rich nations promised to donate have been delivered so far. And this week, Germany said it expected to miss its target to donate 100 million doses this year, due in part to legal restrictions imposed by vaccine manufacturers. Some of these restrictions are detailed in a new damning report by the consumer group Public Citizen called Pfizer's Power that looks at Pfizer's contracts with the United States, United Kingdom, European Commission, Albania, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Dominican Republic, and Peru. They offer a rare glimpse into the power Pfizer has to silence governments, throttle supply, shift risk, and maximize profits in the middle of a global public health crisis. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen, author of this new report. Find out, lay out for us your findings, Zane.
We are in the worst public health crisis in over a century, and Pfizer has used its monopoly over a life-saving vaccine, a remarkable vaccine, to extract really concerning concessions from desperate governments around the world. And so we detail six examples. And I should say that the contracts are mostly the same, but there are variations within each contract. But almost all the contracts contain, for example, a provision that allows Pfizer to control, essentially, what is said about the contracts. Almost all the contracts contain a provision that says if there is a vaccine shortage, then Pfizer gets to unilaterally decide what the priority of deliveries is, and the countries will simply accept those terms. There's provisions about donations, and Pfizer gets to say whether a country can either donate a Pfizer vaccine or even accept a donated Pfizer vaccine. And so there's just all kinds of things in these contracts.
They cannot take donated vaccine. You have countries that are dealing, in the Western world, even if there are issues of vaccine hesitancy, the majority of people have been vaccinated. You have countries where we're talking about in the single digits. Can you talk more about this, that they're not allowed to accept donated vaccines? We're talking to Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen. He's author of the new report, Pfizer's Power. I think we might have just lost him, and we're trying to get him back up. It is a very important report on how Pfizer has silenced governments while maximizing profits during the pandemic. It goes on to talk about the Brazilian government accepting a contract with Pfizer that contains most of the same terms that the government once deemed unfair. Brazil waived sovereign immunity, imposed no penalties on Pfizer for late deliveries, agreed to resolve disputes under a secret private arbitration under the laws of New York, and broadly indemnified Pfizer for civil claims. Brazil's contract says it can't make any public announcement concerning the existence, subject matter, or terms of the agreement, or comment on its relationship with Pfizer without Pfizer's prior written consent. It sounds like Pfizer's far more powerful, Zane, than any of these countries.
And that's the tragedy here, right? That governments around the world have propped up Pfizer by awarding government-granted monopolies and enabling a system of international intellectual property protection that empowers Pfizer. And so you have Pfizer becoming king, in a sense. And that is outrageous in this pandemic.
We're going to end this discussion here, but we're going to continue and post it online right after the broadcast at democracynow.org. Zane Rizvi is law and policy researcher for Public Citizen. He's author of the new report, Pfizer's Power. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has two full-time job openings, director of finance and administration, as well as a human resources manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team. Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Jarena Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
De voir son groupe préféré sur scène, il y a pensé toute la semaine. Il a acheté son billet, il a mis son chandail du groupe, il s'est rendu à la salle de spectacle. Il n'a pas pu rentrer dans la salle de spectacle. Il a rangé son chandail du groupe, il a acheté son billet et il y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. En septembre, le passeport vaccinal sera exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Que calhar